Oyez, the United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Bruce Castle presiding. All who have business before this court draw near, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Chief Judge Castle. To my right is Judge Hagel. To my left is Judge Green. We're here today in the matter of Mr. Vasquez Flores, docket number 050355. Would counsel of the parties please note your appearance for the record?
Kathy Biederman on behalf of the appellant, and with me is Jeannie Mark.
Thank you. Welcome.
Deborah Bernal on behalf of the secretary, and with me is Karen Washington.
Thank you and welcome. Are both parties ready to proceed?
Yes, ma'am.
Each party will have 30 minutes to present argument. Counsel for the appellant, do you wish to receive a portion of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, sir. I'd like to reserve 15 minutes for rebuttal.
15 minutes?
Yes.
You have it. You may begin.
Thank you. May it please the court. The issue here is whether Mr. Vasquez Flores may be paid attorney fees for work related to his argument that VA provided inadequate VCA notice regarding his claim for an increased rating for his service-connected nephrolithiasis.
Let me take you through a couple things. It might help my mind anyway. In the original VF, 22 Vet App 37,
yes,
the court found R&B error as to denying the psych disorder. Found some problems with the fact that there was no English translation, and found a notice error with regard to the nephrolithiasis increased rating. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And in the second VF, because the notice error was appealed by the secretary.
Correct.
In the second VF, we reinstated that portion with regard to the psych disorder. As to the kidney, I'm going to call it kidney disorder. It's because it's easier to say.
It is.
We found that there was notice error but no prejudice.
Correct.
With regard to an extra scheduler, we never addressed and found error. What we said is it was inextricably intertwined with the fact that we were remanding the claim for benefits for a psych disorder. And then we found separately, sua sponte, a TDIU had been reasonably raised. Is that a fair summary?
That is correct.
All right. So where is the error finding with regard to the claim for benefits for a kidney disorder that was argued by you?
Well, Your Honor, in support of, in your second Vasquez Flores decision, don't have it right in front of me.
I know you have it memorized, though, so go
that's
ahead.
That's right, I have it memorized. In support of the court's discussion regarding the remand for the increased rating for nephrolithiasis on the extra scheduler basis, you cite two decisions. You cite TYRUS, which stands for the proposition of intertwining.
Inextricably intertwined, right?
Correctly.
Which would not necessarily be an error, would it?
Correct. But you also cite Thune, which, had it been decided when the original brief was filed, would have been cited. It mirrors the argument.
So let me just get to the heart of it. Are you arguing that we implicitly found error? Because we don't explicitly find error.
No, you're right. Correct.
Other than in the TDIU, which was not argued.
Agreed.
So. Are you arguing because Thune was cited, there was implicit error, finding of error?
I would say yes. And Thune, again, mirrors the holding in Thune mirrors the argument that was made in appellant's brief regarding the board having provided inadequate reasons and bases for the denial of an extra scheduler rating.
What's the court's law with regard to...
But your argument in the extra scheduler rating applied to the increased rating claim or to the... Well, it couldn't have applied to the mental claim because that had not been found service connected.
Correct. The argument in the brief, the opening brief, it starts on the bottom of page 14 and concludes on the top of page 17, is that the board did not adequately explain its rejection of an increased rating for nephrolithiasis And the discussion pertains to an extra scheduler rating. And the discussion in the argument pertains to the fact that Mr. Vasquez-Flores had additional symptoms of his kidney disease. I'm doing it too now.
I don't blame you.
That were not contemplated by the rating schedule, particularly excruciating pain accompanied by nausea, vomiting, headache, while he was in the process of passing kidney stones.
But the issue, we never found that. We never said you raised this particular argument with regard to extra scheduler as an error below. What we said was, in light of the fact that we're remanding this other psych disability claim for benefits, that would naturally have to be discussed on remand. And so, consequently, what is our case law with regard to the requirement that there be a finding of error? This gets even more complicated, and as you saw in the briefing, I granted reconsideration, sent it to panel to discuss the issue of, if you didn't argue error with regard to TDIU, and we sua sponte found that, you made an argument that you are a prevailing party because there was a remand based on error. And I think I had said you weren't a prevailing party in the original decision that I'm reconsidering. So if you're a prevailing party in the concept and idea that there is an error found by the board, but if the error was found sua sponte by the board and no other error was addressed in the court with regard to the claim for benefits for a kidney disability or disease, what does our case law say with regard to that?
Your Honor, first, if I may, prevailing party is a threshold finding that applies to the case as a whole. Mr. Vasquez is, without any question, a prevailing party in this case because his claim, either one of them, one of his claims was remanded based on a finding of error, the psych disability claim. Okay? Without a question, that makes him a prevailing party. It's not...
But doesn't our case law fairly clearly differentiate if you have a claim for benefits for one particular disability and a claim for benefits for another disability? If you're successful on one claim, you are prevailing party. If you were not successful at all on the second claim for benefits, you would not be a prevailing party on that aspect. Isn't our case law pretty clear on that?
I don't think that's right, Your Honor. I think that
can
Mr.
you cite Vasquez- any case law that supports the position that in that instance?
I think that what you mean, Your Honor, is that his argument in support of that second.
No, I think what I mean claim. Is our case law is pretty clear, is it not, that the claims for separate disabilities are treated as separate claims, and you can prevail on one and not prevail on another. Is that not? I mean, if I'm wrong, just cite me to the cases. I'm open.
I think that...
Otherwise, I got to go back and research all this.
Your argument is that you can be a prevailing party because you got a remand.
Correct.
No matter how many arguments are presented to the court.
Correct. And then I think
then the question is whether or not you get reimbursed for your cost on those arguments.
And I think that that's addressed under perhaps the question of reasonable. What's reasonable to be paid as an
attorney? Is it reasonable
to
give you cost for an argument you didn't win?
Well, actually, Your Honor...
Generally.
Yes, okay. That's
under some circumstances, you could be unsuccessful, but it still could be reasonable to award you cause.
Well, this court, in its Hensley decision, I believe it's Hensley, says that an appellant may be paid attorney fees for arguments that are not successful made in support of claims that are successful. And it's our position that Mr. Vasquez-Flores has one claim for an increased rating for his kidney disease. It's supported by various theories, one which, no question about it, galloped away as the issue of primary interest, which was the notice argument, which started off being successful here, but then ended up being not successful. But that's just one theory in support of the claim for an increased rating. There's a second theory advanced in support of the claim for an increased rating, and that is the extra scheduler theory. You're absolutely right, Chief Judge Castle. It's not squarely, the argument presented by appellant was not squarely addressed in the court's decision. But again, I would...
Well, I guess the concern I'm having is, and as I read the case law, it says that there has to be a finding of error. And so that's what I'm trying to... I'm not finding that finding of error.
But was there a remand of the increased rating claim?
There was a remand of the increased rating claim.
And that remand was based on what?
It was based on, well, the support cited two cases, Tyruse and Thune, and the court's explanation explicitly was that it was because there was evidence in the record indicating that both the physical disability and the psychiatric disability interfered with Mr. Vasquez-Flores' ability to work, that the board should re-examine that question on remand. And again, the authority cited for that is Thune and Tyruse, and Thune mirrors the argument that appellant made in his brief.
Let me ask you, let's leave extra schedule out for a second and the issue of error associated with it. Let's say that we found no error with regard to extra schedule, just for discussion purposes, but we sua sponte found an error with regard to TDIU. Would there be a basis for granting attorney's fees on a remand that is based on error that the court sua sponte finds?
I think that would again fall to the question of reasonableness. I think that Mr. Vasquez would indeed be the prevailing party, but the court might in its discretion say it's not reasonable under these circumstances for you to be paid fees for something that you didn't do.
Both parties agreed that in this case, special circumstances was not a basis for denying EJIA fees. And then the secretary submitted a notice that they filed an argument in another case that special circumstances would be a basis. Do you see, and they haven't stood up yet, but do you see a distinction between this case and the one that they argued in the other?
Honestly, Your Honor, I can't address that because I'm not familiar with the facts of the other case.
Okay.
Is it your position that the court's remand was based upon an issue that was sua sponte raised by the court?
No, Your Honor, and I'll tell you why. I acknowledge TDIU was not addressed in appellant's brief, and the court did notice that and did remand that in particular. But the court also remanded the question of entitlement to an extra schedule or rating, and that was addressed in appellant's brief. There's an argument that occupies 2.5 pages of the brief devoted to that very issue. And although it is not squarely addressed in the decision, there is no denying that the argument was raised. Just as you didn't address it and say, we agree with this argument, neither did you address it and say, we don't agree with this argument.
But doesn't that mean we could have addressed it and found no error but remanded anyway because it was inextricably intertwined?
I suppose it could mean that.
But I want to make sure that, I'm sorry, I want to make sure but that your position, as I understood you stated it, is that you believe, excuse me, Mr. Vasquez-Flores believes that it wasn't the court that raised this issue for which it was remanded sua sponte, it was Mr. Vasquez-Flores that raised it in the initial brief in the guise of a determination of the rating that should have been applied. Do I understand? Maybe I didn't make my question clear enough, but if I did, can you answer it?
Well, I'm not sure that I followed the question, but I'll try to answer the question that I understood. And if I've gotten it wrong, please let me know. Yes, it is our position that Mr. Vasquez-Flores raised the issue of entitlement to an extra scheduler rating Specifically, he argued that the board provided inadequate reasons or bases for denial of an extra scheduler rating. He cited evidence from the record showing that there are additional symptoms associated with his nephrolithiasis that are not contemplated by the rating schedule, and that the board's cursory statement, if you will, just was inadequate as to that aspect of the claim.
And now, would it make any difference whether or not it was extra scheduler rating, TDIU, or just a scheduler rating, ignoring the fact that we found otherwise about scheduler rating? I guess my question is, maybe it's not a question, but our case law, I believe, says that both extra scheduler rating and total rating based upon individual employability are just another means of obtaining a higher rating. Therefore, it fits within a determination of what the appropriate rating is.
Correct.
Do you agree with that?
Yes.
So, would your argument then be that, you know, you're challenging a rating, you've raised extra scheduler rating, and because you've raised that, that you've challenged the rating in general. And regardless of how you get it, that's what you challenged.
We're out of time, but answer Judge Hagel's question, and then we will switch, because you have so much time and remaining, we'll just switch and go after.
Or does that play in here?
I agree with you, Your Honor, that the question of entitlement to an extra scheduler rating is simply another, it is a means of obtaining a higher rating, and that's why I tried in my motion for reconsideration and in my response to the Secretary's opposition to the EJA application to explain that there's a single claim here. It's not one claim for an increased scheduler rating and a separate claim for an extra scheduler rating. It's all part of one claim for a higher rating. Mr. Vasquez-Flores doesn't really care how it happens.
Okay. Of course, there is no such thing as a claim for TDIU or a claim for extra scheduler rating, correct?
It's part and parcel of the claim for an increased rating.
Correct. Okay.
All right. Thank you very much. Can you discuss the court's case law with regard to the requirement that there be a finding of error with regard to a claim to be a prevailing party, just in general, knowing we have a sua sponte finding of error here? And just look at the extra schedule, for example. What's the court's case law with regard to either implicit findings of error or versus the explicit findings of error? Are you familiar with it?
Yes, Your Honor, I am. Well, in your discussion with appellant's counsel, you described the extra scheduler rating as being remanded because it's inextricably intertwined with the service connection claim. The court addressed that issue in Gurley, and that's a prevailing party case where it found that issues that are inextricably intertwined and remanded on that basis, the court has not made an explicit finding of administrative error so that the appellant would not be a prevailing party. However, with that said, we do agree with appellant's counsel to the extent she asserted that prevailing party is a threshold determination, in essence an on or off switch. If a claimant is not a prevailing party, under the EJA, they're not entitled to fees at all. And here, because there were two claims, the service connection claim was remanded based on a finding of administrative error. That alone makes appellant a prevailing party under the Supreme Court's decision in Hensley.
Just to clarify, the court sua sponte found that there was error with regard to the TDIU aspect of an increased rating claim. And is your position that would then make them a prevailing party with regard to that claim?
Well, Your Honor, our position is that because there was administrative error...
Okay, let me go to what you're saying your position is then. Okay. I thought our case law was pretty clear that if you came up with a claim for benefits on A and a claim for benefits on B, that if there was no error associated with the claim on B, you were not a prevailing party on that part of it. Is that not correct? And
well,
can you cite me to case law?
To distinguish, it's... If there's claim A and claim B, and one of those claims was remanded based on administrative error, under the Supreme Court's decision in Hensley, the claimant is a prevailing party for purposes of establishing entitlement to EJA. However, the next step is to address the reasonableness of the EJA.
So that you're understanding that all of our cases where we had claim A and claim B in the situation you just described, that it was all viewed under a prevailing party and it wasn't separated with the prevailing party on A and non-prevailing on B?
Yes, Your Honor, that the claimant is a prevailing party, thereby entitling them to some reasonable EJA fee under Hensley, and that the next step of the process is to determine what fee is reasonable, and only successful claims, it's only reasonable to pay the claimant for claims for
that were successful. I understand that part, but let's assume just for a second you're wrong, and I'm not saying you are, I'll have to go back and check all this, but let's assume for a second that you're wrong. Would not the fact that we found error with regard to the increased rating, even though sua sponte, would that qualify them as a prevailing party on that part of the claim? Or if that was the only claim up here, would that qualify them as a prevailing party?
If the increased rating claim was... If
TDIU, just what we did, we found error with regard to TDIU and we remanded with regard to it. And let's say that was the only claim up here. Would that be prevailing party status and then reviewed under something else?
Your Honor, I believe it would be. However, because appellant's counsel did not ever raise the issue of TDIU, there's no billing for anything related to
TDIU. No, I understand that. I'm still grappling with whether or not the finding of error, sua sponte, by the court with regard to TDIU and remanding of the case, if that were the only thing up here, would that give them prevailing party status, or because it's an error found sua sponte by the court, they are not prevailing party?
Well, Your Honor, if the only, as you stated, is TDIU, was the only remand based on what the court did in this case, which was a finding that was inextricably intertwined with another claim, under Gurley, then appellant would not be...
Well, TDIU we didn't find was inextricably intertwined per se. We found error.
Yes.
All right, so my question is, once again, if we find error with regard to TDIU, sua sponte isn't argued by the appellant at all, does that nevertheless give them prevailing party status, and it's the only claim. Forget the other part. Would that give them prevailing party status? Do you have...
Yes, it would give them prevailing party.
Do you think that would also do it?
It would, but...
And then it's reviewed under reasonableness.
Yes, because under...
Okay, I already got that part. With regard to the question that the court asked you to brief on and the supplement that you gave us, is there a distinction in the two cases? Are you modifying your argument at all? Do you still believe in this case that the... special circumstances does not apply and somehow or another the other case is different?
Yes, Your Honor, we do. We think the case is...
What are those distinctions?
Well, the question that was posed by the court was whether an appellant entitled to EJA when his assertions of prejudicial error are unfounded but the court sua sponte remands. In this case, it wasn't clear to us that the court actually found appellant's assertions of error unfounded.
So is the distinction that in the other case they actually found that the arguments were unfounded, and in this case it was left, we didn't discuss them, we just found it inextricably intertwined, and the distinction is whether you find there's substance to the argument, that merit to the argument or not? Is that the distinction between the two?
That's the distinction we're drawing, yes.
All right. I just wanted to clarify. Thank you.
So let me recap here, because I've been out of it for a while.
Some would say, well, just kidding. Strike that.
In an EJA action, we're talking about a civil action, right? I mean, a civil case, and in that case, you've got three or four different prongs, and the idea is that if the party's position is somehow altered such that the court gives them relief, that makes them a prevailing party, notwithstanding where they necessarily won or lost on those particular prongs.
Yes, Your Honor. If the relief is predicated on a finding
they got a remand
based on administrative error.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then once you find prevailing party, the next question is, the costs that you present, are they reasonable given the different arguments that were made in the case?
Yes, Your Honor, except to some extent, there still has to be a statutory evaluation in terms of whether the secretary's position, the government's position was substantially justified, or whether there are special circumstances that make an award unjust.
Yeah, just.
But when you get beyond that, reasonableness.
Right.
It seems to me that when you're talking about EJIA, you don't jump from prevailing party right to reasonableness, correct?
Yes, correct.
There is this issue of special circumstances that we have to deal with, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, and if there are special circumstances, then that's a bar to EJIA, correct? But you won't even get to reasonableness. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor, yes.
Okay, now, in this case, as I read the briefs in Roberts and in this case, the Secretary takes slightly divergent views on special circumstances. Could you explain that to me?
Your Honor, would you clarify what you mean by divergent views? Do you mean just different positions?
Yes.
We don't believe that the special circumstance exception applies here because since the term is not defined by statute, all we really have to look at are the legislatively recognized exceptions and this court and other courts' case laws addressing special circumstances. Mm-hmm. And typically, the exception has been applied when the government has advanced novel, credible extensions of law or when equitable considerations make an award unjust, which this court has referenced in the past, but only with regard to unclean hands. In the March 7th briefing order, it seemed that the court was asking the secretary whether the special circumstances exception could extend beyond unclean hands, because neither party is asserting that appellant had unclean hands in this case. And we're not making that assertion in Roberts either. But in Roberts, we felt that was an appropriate case where the court may be inclined to expand the special circumstances exception because of the unique facts presented there, which were that appellant's counsel is billed for time spent filing various supplemental briefs and participating in two oral arguments, all of which were about an issue on which the secretary was successful. And appellant's counsel's arguments in the Roberts decision, the court specifically found enumerated through the arguments raised by appellant's counsel and explicitly found all of those arguments unfounded. In this case, it's a bit different because the primary issue addressed at oral argument and in the supplemental briefing was the notice issue under the VCAA. This court originally found that appellant's arguments with regard to that claim were actually persuasive, not unfounded. The secretary appealed to the Federal Circuit, and ultimately, that determination was reversed, and the appeal was returned. And the court found that while the notice was inadequate, appellant had not raised that it was not prejudicial. And the court didn't find appellant's arguments regarding prejudice to be unfounded because he didn't raise any. The court found that it was not prejudicial based on the fact that the notice itself was incomplete as opposed to non-existent. So we didn't feel that under the facts of this particular case that we can make a good faith argument that special circumstances would bar a reasonable EJIA award.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. If there's nothing further, we believe a reasonable award is in order. And
just to clarify then, is the reasonable award you're suggesting nothing because their arguments were not successful? Remind me.
Well, no, Your Honor. We appellants entitled to be paid for the time spent on the remanded psychiatric to service connection.
Let me restate it then. The reasonable award is tied to the part that was psychiatric.
It is tied to the... Oh, sorry. Yes, Your Honor. The reasonable award is tied to the service connection claim. However, general case management tasks cannot be apportioned, and so some payment would be reasonably made for general case management, even though that will go to reviewing the record and such related to the increased rating claim.
Right, but specifically on the increased rating claim, those parts that you can identify for that, you would say no award is reasonable.
Yes, Your Honor. And
okay, that's what I thought you said.
The reason is because with regard to the scheduler increased rating claim, there was no success.
Right.
And with regard to the extra scheduler rating claim, which appellant's counsel does raise in the principal brief, it's only identifiable that 2.8 hours on January 22, 2006 was actually billed toward that particular section of the brief.
Well, did we find error there?
You did not find error, and under Baldridge, which is a reasonableness case, appellant's only entitled to be paid for arguments that actually resulted in a favorable result. So
why isn't the extra scheduler part of the error tied to TDIU?
Well, Your Honor, the court in its 2010 Vasquez-Flores decision addressed the two claims separately. It remanded the extra scheduler claim as inextricably intertwined with the service connection claim, and then it remanded the TDIU claim sua sponte. And the distinction, I believe, for purposes of EJA payment is that with regard to TDIU, counsel has not billed anything toward the TDIU claim because it was never raised by appellant. And with regard to the extra scheduler claim, counsel billed for 2.8 hours with regard to the extra scheduler claim. The court subsequently found no error with regard to the extra scheduler claim, remanded only because it was inextricably intertwined with the service connection claim. And our position is that because no error was found under the principle set forth in Baldridge regarding reasonableness, appellant's not entitled to payment of that 2.8 hours.
This may be the same question as Judge Green asked, but let me try to ask it so maybe I can better understand your answer. Is it fair to say, or would the Secretary agree, that the issue that was raised by appellant was, well, let me ask you, what do you think the issue that was raised by the appellant was in this appeal?
With regard to the extra scheduler claim or in?
No, on appeal was the issue on appeal or the claim on appeal here dealt with, I hate to be like a teacher, with what?
There was two claims, one of which was entitlement to an increased rating for a kidney disorder.
Okay. So before the court this time was an increased rating for kidney disorder. So the issue before the court, was it not increased rating?
It was.
Okay. Now, the court found that, look, tell me if I'm wrong here. There is the possibility of an increased rating, and guess what? Part of that increased rating could be based on the kidney disorder. And, of course, now because they're inextricably intertwined, the kidney disorder and the mental disorder, because those two claims are inextricably intertwined, then TDIU or extra scheduler is necessarily, because of the record, based on a combination, or the argument might be based upon a combination of those two. Is that fair?
Yes.
Okay. So why would the court not have found error by remanding this when the issue here was in fact the appropriate rating, and that was argued by the appellant, although in terms of TDIU, or I'm sorry, in terms of extra scheduler rating, and the court remanded it for that very purpose. Now, if you can understand that question, can you answer it?
I can try.
Okay.
whether the secretary's position is that in its decision, when the court remanded the extra scheduler and TDIU claim, it essentially bifurcated the increased rating claim into two parts, affirming the scheduler portion and remanding the TDIU and extra scheduler.
Okay, can I stop you there? Isn't our case law that in every claim for an increase for the highest rating, that there is a TDIU claim, and I'm not sure about extra scheduler claim, bound in with that? So how does that, how can we divide the two?
Well, may I ask?
Sure.
Are you asking whether or not appellant is entitled to be paid for time billed toward the increased scheduler rating claim that was ultimately affirmed, or just whether or not, if the court found error with regard to the extra scheduler and TDIU, whether he'd be entitlement to payment for that particular portion?
Well, I think what I'm asking is, I think we've agreed that within a rating, and that's what this is, an appeal for an increased rating, there is automatically the issue of whether or not TDIU, and like I said, maybe extra scheduler rating, must be considered, because it's all part of the same issue.
If it's raised by the record, yes. If it's raised by the record, yes.
Or the appellant, right?
Yes.
Now, would you agree that the appellant raised the issue of extra scheduler rating in the appellant's brief such that it should be remanded based on reasons or bases? Is that fair or not?
Well, no, Your Honor, we wouldn't describe it quite the same way. Mm-hmm. We agree that appellant raised the issue in his principal brief, argued that the scheduler criteria did not adequately compensate for his level of disability. Mm-hmm. But that's not the basis that the court remanded the claim on. The court found an alternative basis to remand that claim, instead finding it inextricably intertwined with the service connection claim and did not address the arguments raised by appellants regarding the reasons or basis in the board decision discussing the extra scheduler claim or whether the scheduler criteria itself was adequate.
Well, then let me follow up, and I think this is perhaps a follow-up on Judge Green's question. Let's assume you have another type of claim in civil action. Let's say you have, a tort claim. And the tort claim is based upon negligent, on actual infliction of emotional distress and negligent infliction of emotional distress, let's say. In other words, you got two theories, right? But you got one claim. Basically, what you want is money, right? And the court looks at it and says, you know what? Your claim for intentional infliction of emotional distress is valid. Here's your money. And we don't even have to deal with this other issue, this other theory. Now, why is that? Now, you would say that's being a prevailing party, correct?
Yes.
In this case. But why, under Hensley, would the plaintiff not be entitled to the work they did on the other theory?
Well, Your Honor, because it would have to be, of course, evaluated on a case-by-case basis.
Correct.
And if the court evaluating that tort claim determined that the two theories were just separate theories for advancing one claim, then under Hensley, perhaps they would be able to be paid for the entire amount. In this case...
Even if the court didn't address it, correct? Let's say the court didn't address it, because all the person wants is money, after all.
Well, if the court determined that the arguments made by counsel were toward different theories, were more different theories leading to the advancement of a single claim, then under this court's Hensley decision, the counsel would be entitled to be paid under the EJA. However,
For both,
we just feel this case is different because the court bifurcated, specifically affirming the increased rating claim, making that claim unsuccessful under the Supreme Court's interpretation.
Except for the fact, then how do you explain the fact that our case law says that any case that asks for an increase automatically contains within it the requirement to also consider a higher rating based upon things that are not in the rating schedule?
Well, Your Honor, that's true. However, in the Vasquez-Flores decision, the court explicitly bifurcated them. So while the board had a duty to, apparently, according to the court's decision, consider whether an extra scheduler rating was appropriate due to the fact that it was inextricably intertwined with the service connection claim, the court still found that the finding regarding notice and the increased scheduler rating claim was affirmed. Our position basically is that because there was no success,
it was kind of hard to affirm the increased rating claim. Now that I think about it, if we said there's a TDIU issue,
perhaps, but you did.
Yeah, and maybe it might be just to award.
In fact, a number of cases bifurcate TDIU and scheduler ratings. There's remands of TDIU and scheduler ratings are affirmed, et cetera. So it's not unusual for the case to be done.
Pursuant to Tyruis, but with regard to extra scheduler, that is a little bit more murky. But here
we affirmed the 30% rating, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
We said there's a TDIU issue.
You said there was a TDIU issue, and also that...
And it couldn't apply to the mental condition because that there's no rating to be had on that yet because there's no service connection.
Well, yes, but that will be the same with regard to the extra scheduler claim, and yet
right.
You found it inextricably intertwined with the service connection.
But you can't have extra scheduler until you get
service connection.
Service
in the first.
Connection.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, but you can get extra scheduler if you've got you have an increased rating claim.
Yeah. Yes, Your Honor. But again, on remand, the inquiry would be whether or not the 30% rating. Whether appellant symptomatology was adequately contemplated by the rating criteria for a 30% rating for nephrolithiasis.
Which leads us to the panel issue, which is the secretary and the appellant's view are that her client is a prevailing party because the court sua sponte found error with regard to the increased rating claim on an aspect that was not at all argued by the appellant and found no error with regard to the other aspects of the increased rating, nowhere with regard to the scheduler rating, nowhere founded with regard to extra scheduler. And so the question becomes, if the court finds sua sponte the error associated, is that a base? I think the question before counsel, particularly sent to panel four, was whether special circumstances existed. As I understand it, in this case, both parties agree that that's not a basis in this case to deny it, and then it has to be reviewed for reasonableness. And then the reasonableness, as I understand the Secretary, is that because they were not prevailing with regard to the argument on scheduler, the court found no error with regard to extra scheduler either way and remanded because it was inextricably. And then sua sponte remanded because of TDIU, which was not even argued. The Secretary's position is it would be reasonable to give no fee for that aspect to the extent you could bifurcate just those associated with it.
Yes, Your Honor, that sums it up, except the Secretary's position, and I believe Appellant's counsel asserted this as well, is that Appellant is a prevailing party because there was an administrative error found with regard to the service connection claim, and that finding alone makes Appellant a prevailing party for the entire case.
Regardless of the error, correct.
So
I'm going to check that.
Yes. And in terms of reducing under reasonableness, it wouldn't be because they weren't a prevailing party. It would be because they were not successful on those claims.
Correct. So. Anybody else?
Yes. Did I understand you to say that the secretary had difficulty discerning the court's ruling and this and upon which this appeal is based?
No, Your Honor. What I was trying to convey was that the secretary was not prepared to say that the court found appellant's arguments to be unfounded, since that would be such a significant finding, perhaps equated to frivolous even, and that in this particular case, we were not prepared to say that the court made that finding with regard to the arguments raised by appellant, and because of that, we didn't think that special circumstances would bar entitlement to EJIA in its entirety. If there are no further questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You still have 15 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, with regard to special circumstances, since it was raised by the supplemental briefing order and addressed by my opposing counsel, I don't think it's appropriate to even get to special circumstances, because although the case is court law,
didn't the secretary concede that there were no special circumstances?
The secretary indeed concede that there are no special circumstances, the case law says that
so let's assume that issue is to the side.
Thank you.
Unless one of the other judges asks you questions about it.
I think it's fair that both parties have argued that, and we've heard a distinction in the case, but ultimately the court makes that decision, so...
But the case law indicates, Your Honor, that the secretary bears the burden of proof,
right.
And the secretary's conceded that special circumstances don't apply. So I respectfully submit that it's not an issue here. I think the fallacy with the secretary's argument, Your Honor, is that the secretary persists in his erroneous belief that there are multiple claims for an increased rating. And as I tried to address in my various pleadings and earlier, it's a single claim for an increased rating supported by different theories. One ultimately was not successful.
Now, wait a minute. I'm going to stop you right there. There is no such thing as a claim for increased rating, right? Rating attaches to a claim for disability benefits, because that determines the level of disability benefits, and that has five elements, one of which is the rating.
Increased compensation.
Your Honor, this...
There may be differing views on that, whether it's an increased claim for increased compensation, an increased disability rating, could be anything.
Well, let me just be clear about whether or not there's a difference of opinion. The court's opinion in Rice, I think, makes that specific finding. Am I correct?
Well, Rice defines a claim as an assertion of entitlement to benefits based on a specific disability that's the result of a distinct cause. So,
Increased benefits.
I believe actually the statute refers to increased rating in the context of claims that are authorized by statute. But if you prefer that I call it something else, I will endeavor to do so. His application for an increased disability rating?
Based upon a claim, right? Mm-hmm. So you have two claims here, correct? A claim for mental disability and a claim for kidney stones.
A claim for compensation, right. Service-connected disability benefits for a mental disorder and a claim and...
So the mental disorder was on remand.
Correct.
And you came to the court, the VA and then to the court, seeking an increased rating beyond 30% for kidney stones, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so the increased rating that was at issue here was for the claim based on kidney stones. That was the issue here. That was initially here, correct?
An increased rating for the kidney stone disease, okay. Correct.
Okay. Now, from that. Go ahead, please.
Okay. I think the secretary mistakenly tries to parse that request for increased disability compensation for the kidney disease into what really amounts to different theories in support instead of different claims. And I think that that's where our positions have diverged.
Let me try and do another example outside of this. So somebody argued that they were entitled to service connection, and they argued solely and only on a direct basis. That was the appeal. And at the end of the day, the court said, no, you lose. The discussion by the board, analysis, we affirm the board's decision that you're denied benefits on a direct basis. But the court sua sponte notices that the record raised possible entitlement on a presumptive basis and remands. Would the appellant be a prevailing party?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that he's a prevailing party because
there's a remand.
Because the claim
and would the appellant be entitled to any EJIA fees when the entitled argument presented by counsel was rejected by the court?
This court's Hensley decision tells us that an appellant may be paid for time spent advancing arguments that are not successful in support of claims that are successful as long as those arguments were reasonable. So I think the court would need to evaluate in that case whether the arguments advanced were reasonable. And just because they were ultimately not persuasive and didn't carry the day doesn't necessarily mean that they were not reasonable arguments to make. Unless there are any other questions, I have nothing further.
Thank you very much.
Thank
the case
you.
Will be submitted. We will confound the Greek Council.